everybody, what's going on? This is Andy, a.k.a. Ghosts, and welcome to another sterling episode of CommanderCast. This is Season 4, Episode 5, and joining me for this episode, including more White Hawk community strategy and technology, I have three wonderful guests. As usual, I have my man Donovan, a.k.a. Dosu, with me. Why don't you introduce yourself, please, Donovan?
Hey, everybody. My name is Dosu. I also go by Donovan, I guess, in real life. I'm pretty much
D-Money on the streets, you know, on the mean streets of wherever you are on a given week, since you're traveling all the time now.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, work's got me running back and forth all over the place, but it's all good. I play EDH, like, a lot, and my main archetype is combo. I'll venture out into other archetypes occasionally, just for a change of pace, but I'm pretty much a combo player through and through.
All right, and then joining us for his second round this season, actually I think that's like a first for guests, we have Cassidy Silver from TCGPlayer.com.
Hey, how's it going, guys? I'm a right or a wrong on the internet and all that stuff. And, yeah, like he said, I write for TCG Player. I just wrote an article about Grimgrin that I'm hoping is going to go up by Friday, so it should be available by the time the podcast is up and all that. Been doing a lot of Innistrad Generals lately. And also, I have a blog-type deal. Yeah, youcan'thehandlethenath.com. I got the domain name for it, so stop on by. I always write in random stuff.
Swish. All right. And as well, we have a guest who hasn't been back in a while, actually. It's been like a full season without his presence gracing us. We have Benny Smith. What's been going on with you, Benny?
Hey, how's it going, guys? My name's Benny Smith. I write a weekly column at Star City Games. Been there for a long, long time. And I write a little bit about Commander, write a little bit about Standard. Sometimes I rant. Sometimes I just gush over the new set. Anyway, just whatever floats my boat.
Yeah, so if you need your boat floated, you can head over to starcitygames.com. We will certainly have a link in the show notes if you're so inclined to check that out.
My latest column, which will be up by the time this comes out, will I have a deck list for Gave, Guru of Spores.
Oh, sweet. That sounds lovely. Yes. So this week, in terms of CommanderCast news, the Gifts Given Charity Drive is ongoing, and you'll hear more about that in the upcoming segment, Charity Cases. That's coming up next. I also just want to remind you guys to check back on Wednesday for the midweek update, in which case we'll be going over Max's Pauper Vacation Part 2. If you're interested in checking out the first half, there will be a link in the show notes, and it'll be a nice lead-in to the conclusion of this mini-series. And then on Friday, with the Friday Flashback, as always, we'll have our unstoppable barrage of links. And then we're also going to have Sean, a.k.a. Shorts of the Plow. He's going to be throwing up the Arkham Engine and talking about the general that he is definitely most well-known for playing. So if you want some insight into how to roll around with that bastard artificer, you can be sure to check into that article. We don't have a whole lot else going on this week, so let's just take it right into community. We're going to be going over the charity cases that we've received this week for Gifts Given and the wonderful things that you people have been donating to us for Child's Play. So welcome to the first week of Charity Cases. In case you didn't listen to last week's podcast, we started a fundraising drive on CommanderCast last week called Gifts Given. And the idea is that people will donate cards to me, and in turn, I will sell them on eBay and donate 100% of the proceeds to Child's Play. I want to go back over everything on the podcast here because it'll take a bunch of time. But if you're not aware of what's going on with it, I would like you to check it out. Please go over to CommanderCast.com, and there's links all over the place, but the main one is on the right sidebar with the rest of the widgets. It's called Gifts Given, and it's got a little Kamigawa expansion symbol with a bow tie on it. So check that out if you have any interest in contributing. I'd really appreciate it personally, and I'm sure the good people at Child's Play would as well. But in any case, the whole idea behind this segment is it's one where I'm going to mention the people that have sent in all these great stuff, great things for the Gifts Given drive, give them a little recognition, and as well, if they have any inclination to, I'll be reading out any message that they've given to us. Most people don't seem too interested in using that so-called Jumbotron time so far, but if you have any interest of your own when you send it in, don't be shy about it, because it's there for you to use, right? Now, I will say our first week has been a dramatic success, especially compared to where I thought things would be at this point. To be honest, when I introduced the concept, I wasn't sure that people were going to care at all. I thought some people might actually get mad and say, oh, I don't know, man. I don't listen to this podcast to get hassled about charity, but nobody said anything negative so far, certainly, and the positive response has been like almost literally overwhelming, and that sometimes I can't keep up with the emails people are sending in to me about contributions. But this week I have six new contributions I'd like to list off as well. I'm going to mention the two that kind of got everything kickstarted. So let's just get it rolling here. First of all, I have Ulysses, and I know I'm pronouncing that right because I asked him about it, and he made one of the first contributions of everybody. And it's an incredibly sweet one. He gave us 4 birthing pods and a Jace the Mind Sculptor. So he's going to be sending those in. I haven't actually received them yet, but he has pledged them. I've got the photo evidence, so it's all going to be good. I'm sure they're in the mail, and I'm really looking forward to getting those, and I'm sure there's people that are looking forward to buying them. Now, he's the only person that actually chose to make use of the Jumbotron, and he gave me the following message. I would just like to let the community know on CommanderCast to take time out and appreciate those they love. You never know when life throws you a bomb, so you should just take the time to make sure that those you love are appreciated. A little cliche, I know, but you never realize how true it rings until it happens to you. And yeah, I think that's part of the reason that so many people are so far behind this Gifts Given charity drive here is you never know if something's going to happen. It's, God forbid it's your kid or another a child that you know. Anyway, so yeah, thanks for that, Ulysses. Super appreciate it. And thanks for the nice little message as well. Secondly, I've got Devin here. He sent in a fairly large lot. This is the first thing that I've received, actually, in physical form. That's the cards rattling around inside the case that he sent to me. It's a huge lot. There's a variety of foils, some From the Vault Legends stuff, and a bunch of fun EDH stuff. So can't find any fault there. Good overall value. There's all kinds of delicious stuff in here, especially for EDH. Some of my personal favorites as well, like Chandra Blaze up in this bitch. We got Rexxiel the Risen Deep. Hell yeah. Visara, you can't go wrong with that. And, of course, the perennial favorite, Kresh the Bloodbraided, and in the From the Vaults version. So that's a bit of a unique find outside the box. So thank you, Devin. He didn't give me a message to read, but I would like him to be acknowledged. And he's also the first person that I've actually received something from in physical form. So it got here in like a day, which was a little bit surprising. He sent it yesterday, so that's pretty much awesome. Also, Devin is apparently a writer, and he did mention something about the possibility of sending in something to CommanderCast. So you never know. You might see him in the one of the midweek updates or the Friday flashbacks in the near future. Next, I have Andrew, and he sent in a huge list. It's way too long for me to go over it all. But it's primarily uncards, which I thought was an interesting angle to take on this, because I certainly didn't think anyone would send those in. But yeah, it's awesome, because these cards are really cool. They're interesting novelties. There's 5 Mox Lotus in there, which have some secondary market value. I guess some people really like those. And as well as all the huge lot of unstuff that he sent in, there's also some nice commander stuff thrown in there as well. Some random foils and some generals, that kind of thing. So this is a huge list. I think it's around 150 cards that he's sending to me. Varying values, and he says he's not sure exactly how well they'll sell, so he says that it was cool to give them out as well as part of the weekly raffles, which I do intend on doing once I receive some. So if you're a winner in some of these super secret mystery prize giveaways, the video will be up on Sunday for the first time, barring technical mishap. You might also find some uncards have infiltrated your package when they arrive at your house, but he didn't give me a message either. But I would like to thank you, Andrew, for sending those in. That was a very gracious donation of yours, and I'm sure everyone's looking forward to getting their hands on those Frankie Peanuts. Next, I've got Matt, and Matt has a very cool altar that he's donating. It's altered by Eric Klar, I think. You know me in pronunciation. Anyway, Eric Klar is how I'm going to say it, and it's Riptide Laboratory, and this thing looks fucking awesome. It's a sick altar. If you have a Riptide Lab in your deck and you're into pimp cards, you're not going to get a whole lot pimper than this, so thanks again, Matt. That's a fantastic donation, and that's one I might personally be bidding on, because I just love putting Venser back in my hand with a Seedborn Muse in play. And then we've got a longtime home of mine, Scott Holmes. Awesome. He's a nurse, and we correspond quite a bit. He emails me just about once a week, talks to me about whatever happened on that week's episode. We have a good bit of back and forth. He's a nurse and I'm a paramedic, so we share stories every now and then. And he has a very generous donation of 2 cards. He's giving us the Mirrodin Pure Preston Talisman, which is something of a novelty, because I guess it's the only card ever printed with the Mirrodin Pure expansion symbol, so that's pretty cool. And he has another one of a kind. It's a Borderland Ranger altered by MJ Scott. So a funny story behind that card as well. He mailed it in. Apparently he won it in an eBay auction to support MTG Cast, and then he said, well, I might as well send it in to support another podcast related charity. So that was awesome. As always, Scott, you know, good looking out. And then last but certainly not least of the new donations that I haven't received this week, but I've had confirmed pledged, we have something coming from Lance. This is by far the most valuable contribution that we've received so far. Not to devalue everybody else's, but this is pretty crazy. When I first saw it, I actually asked him if he was being completely serious, because I couldn't tell. He's sending us an unlimited Mox Emerald, and it's signed by the artist. It's in mint condition. I've seen the photo, and it looks awesome. So that's pretty unreal. Like I mentioned a couple times, CommanderCast listeners are apparently a secret cabal of super baller charitable people with moxes and birthing pods and all kinds of other deliciousness sitting around just waiting to give away for someone to ask. So Huge ups to you, Lance. Can't appreciate that enough. He hasn't given me a message to read either, but I have a message for you, and that is that that's totally awesome. And finally, we've got the two donations that were kind of the Kickstarter for the whole thing. Sean, a.k.a. Swords to Plow, he sent me in a Force of Will in mint condition. And I've got Durfington, who agreed to do a free alter on pretty much any card that the auction winner chooses. And I really appreciate those guys coming out and supporting me on this. To be honest, I wasn't sure I was going to do it. The idea was out there. And I've kind of been floating it around to people, but I don't know. There was never a real strong response to my initial pitch. But then Sean just said, yeah, I'm in. And when his Force of Will showed up in the mail, it was actually kind of kicking the nuts that said, like, okay, now you have to do this. You're locked in. And Durfington was basically in the same boat when he said, oh, yeah, for sure, I'll do this. Those initial kind of concrete, dedicated donations were the things that really got me off my ass and made me get to this. So you two guys kind of have a special place in this, and I really want to thank you guys for those initial donations that got things popping with gifts given. But that's it for charity cases this week. So those are the donations that I've had confirmed. Many more were sent in, but I haven't gotten all the details yet on the pledges. So that's why I haven't read them all off this week. But don't worry, there's going to be next week. And like I said, I'm accepting donations until December, so don't feel left out. And if you want, take your time, figure out what kind of message you want to send in. If you want to send in an MP3, I'll just splice it into the podcast at this point. So that's perfectly cool. But yeah, it's hard to thank you guys for your generosity. This is, like I said, way more successful than I thought it would be when it first started. And even now, I'm still amazed. It's only week one. And the amount of monetary value that I've raised in cards and donations is mind-blowing. So I'm getting a little emotional here, but that was that's really awesome, guys. So in terms of details as well, some people have asked me if there's other things that they can donate. I had one person offer to donate some Warhammer figures. Other people have asked about cash donations. Those are fine, too. Just email me and we'll work something out. For the cash donations, we'll probably do PayPal for non-magic physical items. I suppose we'll have to work out shipping, or optionally, we'll do a remote auction. You can be the seller, and then we can just donate the proceeds to the gifts given thing, or optionally, you can just donate it directly to Child's Play. And that's an option that you guys should certainly consider as well. You don't have to do it through gifts given. Feel free to just, if you have a bunch of crap laying around, I do this almost once a year. I sell off gaming stuff that I know still has some value and give the proceeds to Child's Play, so I would encourage you to do the same. But that's it for this week's gifts given update on charity cases. Next, we're going to take along into our community segment. We're going to kind of flip the script here, and we're going to be talking about douchology for the first time ever.
For the second segment in the community segment, we're going to talk about douchology, which I believe is going to be a regular segment here on the show.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
So basically the idea is there are some personalities that just, you know, tend to ruin a game of Commander regardless of where they're sitting and basically what they're playing even. This week, as I mentioned, we're starting the douchology series. We're going to discuss the taxonomy of the various douchebags we encounter in the wilderness of EDH. Now, how do we recognize them? Maybe sometimes we fall into these categories ourselves, which I know I do. And how can one reverse this behavior pattern, either in yourself or others? I guess what we're going to start with is Salt Truck, as I think Andy came up with this one.
Yes, this would be one that I'm quite familiar with as a salt truck that sometimes just veers out of control and spills the game, ruining everyone's experience.
So why don't you tell us about the Salt Truck then, Andy? That sounds good.
Yeah, sure. The Salt Truck is basically like the whiny bitch in your group, and I'm sure everyone has one of those, because God knows that I've been it more than once. The thing that characterizes the Salt Truck over the typical like garden variety whiny bitch, though, is things they only become real salty when things just aren't going exactly their way. Sometimes it can feel justified. I know that's normally when I start to get into it. Like, let's say I'm playing a deck that's maybe not even that good, and get all the removal seems to be pointed at my stuff. I can't get anything to stick on the board. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I get a little miserable despite myself when those kind of things happen. It's frustrating. It feels like you can't influence a game at all, and everyone is conspiring to get you. And that's the salt truck mindset that leads to, you know, spilling salt all over the place and just getting super sour. And normally the things that characterize somebody that's in, like, salt truck mode is they're very, like, pouty. Like, they sit there and there's a lot of, like, oh, well, I can't do anything. And they'll say, like, really passive-aggressive things like, oh, well, you must be just swimming in removal there if you're going to point that at my thing. You know, like, a lot of criticizing other people's plays despite the fact that you're having no impact on the game at all. You should probably just shut the fuck up and take your licks. But yeah, the salt truck's real corrosive. Ooh. Awesome. Yeah, he's a very corrosive personality to have at the table because it's so easy to make things feel like awkward by just a couple of remarks, especially if everyone else is like just kind of trying to enjoy themselves. And then every time, you know, you draw a card, you look at it and you slap your hand back down on the table and you're like, well, I can't go do anything. Take your turn. It's just really unpleasant to deal with or, in my case, and I have no problem with admitting this, being this guy sometimes, it sucks. What leads you to is like this downward spiral of negativity. Like you're not able to do anything, which frustrates you. So you get vocal about it. And then you get like more and more negative. And a lot of times I think people start to destroy your stuff out of spite because you're being a dick. And then, yeah, obviously that's not going to improve the situation. So maybe I just have, like, really spiteful friends like the aforementioned Tony Stark. But I don't think that's it. I think most of the time this comes from your own kind of EDH heart of darkness here. And you just transform yourself into this overwhelming vortex of negativity that risks sucking the whole game down there with you.
Oh, okay, I got you. I'd usually just... I usually like to egg those kind of people on, you know.
Yeah, so you're that asshole I'm talking about. Yeah, it just provokes this guy.
It won't even take like a bunch of it. As soon as you start whining a little bit, you just gotta go. Like you said, it'll bring down the whole game, and I don't like dealing with whiners at all. So that sounds like exactly someone I would not like.
And the other thing is too, it's not just generic whining like, oh, that card's overpowered, or oh, that's stupid, or why isn't that banned? Like that's. I think that's more just being a Magic player, that kind of whining, right? It's always like really specifically related to the game and the situation they're in, and a lot of the time it springs from that kind of, like I was describing earlier, the feeling of helplessness. Like, in Magic, the whole goal is to interact with your opponents, not necessarily through conventional means like destroying their permanents, but maybe by depleting their life total with a super cool interactive storm combo or something. But you want to do something, and if it just feels like you can't get anything going, it makes you feel so shitty.
I think I'm in the same boat as Andy on this one. Like, I catch myself doing this sometimes, and I try really hard to not get, like, too emotionally attached to just, like, a game of Magic.
Yeah, like, but, Donovan is a better man than me, so this surprises me.
I wouldn't go that far, but I have noticed that I tend to be more sensitive, like, if I just build a new deck and I want to try it out and I want to see it work. Like, just once, I want to see it work. And my old playgroup was pretty cutthroat, and I'm cool with that because we're all pretty thick-skinned around here. But, for example, like the first game we play, Grand Arbiter player gets turn one Soul Ring into Grand Arbiter and then clones it on the next turn. And then Sakashima's it the turn after that. I'm like, oh my god, and he just like crushes that game, and I don't do much of anything. And then the next game, the Sisei player just like ramps out of control and then like Armageddons everybody, and he's got like a ton of fatties out. And I was just getting kind of annoyed that, you know, I can't just see my new deck do what it's supposed to do, and instead I just keep getting all my lands blown up effectively. But at the same time, just gotta chill out and remember it's a game, because I really don't want to be the salt truck in the future. It's zero fun for anybody.
Yeah, I had to laugh with it. Like, I wasn't even thinking of salt, like the salt that you'd spread for ice and stuff. I was just thinking of, like, endless tears that have dried.
I think, like, that's a perfectly legitimate way to put it, you know?
But I had to admit that I been the salt truck on occasion myself, too. And it's like you said, especially like, you know, when Donovan was mentioning you lovingly spend a bunch of time to build your deck, you just wanted something to come together. You know, some one or two of the combos that you've put in there, some cool plays. And, you know, you sit down and your opponents are all playing in some kind of crazy combo and they're just annihilating you and you've got nothing going on. And I sometimes succumb to the salt truck and start getting really irritated.
I think there's a jealousy factor, too. You see everyone else doing cool things.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there like, well, I guess I'll play this land that I managed to draw. Winner! You know, it's not a great feeling. Now, before we get on to our second douchebag of the week here, I kind of want to talk about how you, like, we've gone over the symptoms of being the salt truck, what leads to it. Now, how would you guys reverse it? Now, I think Cassidy's option of just boot fucking them into the ground, probably not the best socially, unless you have a really good group of friends. But
they'll learn eventually.
Exactly. It is a legitimate solution, especially if they're really caustic to the game environment. at that point, maybe you should, you know, just remove them from the situation, you know?
Exactly.
This way they can no longer influence everybody in a negative manner. It might produce harsh feelings, but usually I also find another thing with the salt truck is it's very short term, like it's reversible. I think once you move beyond being like the, you know, one game salt truck into this carrying over, you've stopped kind of being an EDH, like, douche-ology douchebag, and you're more just an asshole all the time, probably. You're probably just a bitter, petty person that no one really likes. So, wow.
I like these wild generalizations.
This is real talk here, but, yeah, you know, so I think usually the salt truck thing is reversible, so I think just eliminating someone from the game is an easy way to resolve it, because when that game's over, they're going to come back in the next game, they'll have, like, that strengthened resolve, you know, they'll be on their Rocky 2, as it were, and ready to come back into this game with renewed vigor, come back and play a more interactive game where they have more influence.
Why not look at it a different way, too? Like, maybe this makes group hug decks actually something worthwhile. You know, just bring a group hug deck to big games, so that when someone starts getting too salt trucky, you just start giving them cards or letting them draw cards so that they'll shut up. Maybe group hug is actually useful. So.
Like actually overtly assisting the salt.
Yeah.
To keep them from spraying more salt. Yes, that's certainly a valid option as well, because if they can't get something going like by you kind of greasing the wheels there for them, you know,
right,
I think
exactly.
Even the worst players like me have to realize their deck's just not good.
I was thinking maybe another option too would be talk about what could have happened to you when, you know, you've stuck curb stomp salt truck into the ground and the game is over and they're very sad and whiny about the situation. You might say, well, thank God you didn't have card X to put a stop to that, so that you can kind of passive aggressively suggest them improving their deck a little bit, you know?
that's good.
Actually, that's funny too, because like the post game I would have won if guy is like a whole other douchebag, you know? But maybe you can make him feel like he could have won. You know, not even like
you
putting
could have won if guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, that like lift his spirits up so he feels better before the next game. Like, well, you know, we had to get you because, you know, if we didn't, you just would have killed us, you know.
It's a good thing your deck sucked or you might have beat me.
All right. And with that, we're going to move on to our next case of doucheology, which is Scoopy McGee. So we'll let Cassie lead this one up because this is somebody apparently he's very familiar with.
Yeah, I have one of my friends that I play a lot of EDH with that likes to scoop, and it's not even that like the board state isn't favorable and you know you're gonna lose so you scoop, which is fine with me. It's more like, oh, I just drew my eighth land and I don't feel like playing anymore, so he scooped and I turned seven. It was really weird. So also he's the same guy who scooped in a match for no real reason. I don't know why he did. And then he decided to unscoop and attack a different player. It's kind of weird. Like, he packed up the deck, and then he's like, oh, wait, I could attack you instead. Okay, hold on. Let me get set up again so I could send some troops your way. I have no problem with people that scoop when, you know, you're going to lose just so you can start another game. That sounds good. But the random scooping for no reason is pretty irksome and not, you know, it's just not fun to play against, honestly, so.
Yeah, the worst thing about Scoopy McGee is that unlike the salt truck, whose disruption is mostly, like, social, having a guy scoop prematurely or seemingly for no reason or when they don't want to explain why or just out of spite actually disrupts the mechanical flow of the game. Like, the actual game itself is heavily influenced by a single-player exiting because if you could think of it, all resources that have been sent towards that player disrupting them and hurting them were effectively wasted because they've just elected voluntarily to take themselves out of the game. So you need a kind of a cumulative effort to remove a player. And then when they voluntarily take themselves out as an elective, you've nullified all that effort that people have put into that game. And it just cheapens the whole feel of the game as well. It's not the same as the douche scoop, which is another segment I'm sure we'll run again in the future. But we kind of have our own lexicon here now. Like the tactical concession guy is kind of another story because that's generally, you know, pretty much strictly out of spite. But they usually do it when they're close to losing or are about to lose anyway.
Right, right.
Whereas this guy, Scoopy McGee, just like, it seems like you could roll dice to determine when he scoops. You know? Like just, oh shit, scoop time! You know? Like pulls his cell phone out, oh snap, got a scoop! You know? And then, like you were saying, too, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. The worst of all, though, is definitely like the unscoop. Like, oh, well, maybe I was still in it, you know? And then They gotta go through all their stuff, and it's like, oh, I think you shuffled your graveyard in. Oh, which ones are in your hand? And then you have to wait, like, forever for this Herpderp to figure out what he had and what he didn't have. Oh, my God, it is the worst. So just don't be this guy. This is a bad one to be. And on the plus side, this is an easy species of douchebag to spot in the wild. And it's an easy one to know that it's kind of self-diagnose, because it's obvious. How many games do you scoop in? When was the last time you conceded? Why did you do it? Did everyone say, why are you giving up? If so, you're probably one of these guys.
I've noticed one of the things that might prompt Scoopy McGee to scoop is when he or she loses, like, a huge rules argument. They're just like, well, if you're playing that way, I don't want to play anymore. They kind of take
really?
Their ball and go home. I've seen this on several occasions.
Is this like an online thing or in the real?
Yes.
Like, oh!
I mean, you know, some of the rules arguments that make you scratch your head, and it's just like, how can I argue with this person because what they're claiming is so out of left field? And
you're just
I'll see if I can give you an example.
Reality than you are.
Like, okay, I was playing a Chimeric Idol. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Okay. You know, you have to tap all. It says tap all lands you control, turn into a 3/3 till end of turn. And so I go to do that, and then someone says, "Wait, like all your lands are already tapped. You can't activate that." And I'm like, "What?"
Oh.
And like most of the table agreed that I had to have at least one land untapped to activate my Chimeric Idol.
No one
scooped it. I don't know. Like, how do I argue about
space?
That? I was outnumbered. But in any case, like, no one scooped in that particular scenario, but that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. If we argue for, like, 5 minutes, and then they lose the argument, they're just like, oh, whatever. Peace out, dog.
Just like that. And they gone.
Yes.
They bounce.
I have to say that, luckily, I don't have too many Scooby McGee's that I've run across. But I think, you know, it's just mostly sounds like you just gotta get a hold of your emotions, you know. You gotta not let yourself get invested in any particular way that the game's going or a particular game. You know, you just gotta step outside, get some fresh air, you know, go get you a soda, take a little break.
Yeah.
You know, don't just scoop up your cards. I mean, we all get, you know, everyone's got a temper and can lose it, you know, for other factors. You just gotta, you know, realize that you're there to have some fun.
I think it's kind of the same solution I had for the assault truck. I just kind of poked fun at it. You know, that's where Scoopy McGee came from. You know, I named him that, and then I called him that. And he kind of got over it, you know, after I just kept making fun of him. And he doesn't really Scoopy McGee anymore, but it certainly was, it was outrageous for a little while how many scoops he would have. And that's, I guess it's kind of the tactic I learned from Red Foreman from 70s Show.
Yeah, just badger them to change their ways.
Exactly. The Red Foreman method, that's pretty much how I deal with those guys.
All right, so that was our first segment on Doucheology. This segment has been brought to you by Morton's Iodized Salt. When it rains, it pours. So that's it for Community this week. Next, we're going to move into the strategy segment. We're going to be doing an archetype rundown on Voltron.
All right, this week in the strategy segment, the first thing we're going to do is another archetype rundown. This week, we're going to be talking about Voltron strategies, or as Andy likes to spell them in the show notes, Voltron archetypes.
What the trend?
In case you're not familiar with the Voltron archetype, more or less it just revolves around casting your general and trying to get there with the 21 general damage, and you usually suit it up with all kinds of like auras or equipment or other various buffs. Good examples are like Xur the Enchanter or Ural the Miststalker, or, you know, those guys that you've probably seen a lot and some that you haven't. But in any case, let's talk about what they're good against, what they're weak against, and why you should play them or not.
The main thing that is my experience with these decks, the reason that you play them a lot of the time, and I don't mean to say this in an offensive way to anybody, but often it's like the first deck you build in Commander. Because it's a new format, it's interesting to you, this general thing is a novelty, and this is literally the only archetype that can only exist in Commander. You can build decks that revolve around buffing one creature in other formats, but this is the only format where you're rewarded by the introduction of a brand new resource in terms of general damage. that makes this archetype work. Because the value, obviously, in these Voltron decks is that it has the damage that you have to inflict to a given opponent, and the risk is that you have to get it all from one source. But that source recurs, so it kind of creates this interesting tension, and I think for people that are new to the format, it's a very novel concept, and it is something interesting I think most players should tinker around with at least once, just to explore that axis of the game. On the downside, they are a little linear. They tend to be less interesting, in my experience, to people that have been playing Commander for a long time. Because once you see these generals, a lot of the time you know exactly where the deck's going. You know what kind of game plan they want to get into, how long it'll take them to get going on it. You know the strengths and the weaknesses. So they become a little more stale a lot of the time, especially if you've played the deck a lot back-to-back. Because really, at the end of the day, all it revolves around is casting one guy and then beating people to death with one guy.
I like the Voltron strategies a lot. Especially for big creatures that are big generals rather that are really cheap to cast, especially like Ruhan, the new guy from the commander box. You know,
Ruhan smash.
Indeed, yeah. That's going to be part of the article this week too. With Grimgrin, I kind of give a update on that deck because I've been playing it a lot. But it's just I like Voltron a lot because I like to use the white, you know, the white equipment tech and just the equipments in general. And I really don't think they're kind of more generic in decks that aren't Voltron, I guess. Like, Stoneforge Mystic is just kind of like a staple in general, but when it's in a Voltron deck, it's like you're almost like you're one of your best cards in the entire deck. And it's good for one-on-one games, too. That's the other thing. I really like playing Ruhan in one-on-one for obvious reasons because of his ability and stuff. Like you said, it is very linear. Getting tucked is probably the worst for a Voltron deck.
Ooh, yeah, that is pretty nasty. Yeah. Oh no, my game plan. And
right,
just
exactly.
Watch it go into your deck.
And especially for Ruhan, because red, white, blue has very few ways to search for creatures. You just gotta like maybe gamble, and either way, he's gonna go into either your hand or your command zone. So that's a good way to do it. Or also the new one from Innistrad, Cellar Door, actually pulls stuff off the bottom of the library. So if your general gets hindered, you can just Cellar Door him back into your graveyard and then the command zone and use them again. So I've had some pretty good luck with those cards to get around Tuck. But besides that, it's pretty easy to play. Tuck is no problem.
That's an awesome piece of technology there. I hadn't even thought about Cellar Door as anti-Tuck technology.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
that's a great idea. Yeah, I have to admit, I've had some fun with some Voltron decks, but I could not get my Ural deck to be any good, and it kind of drove me crazy for a while, and I finally dismantled them. I don't know. I was very unsuccessful in my in the one Voltron deck that I really wanted to get to come together. Maybe I'll have to send it in to Sean McKellen for a deck doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, a little crossover there. It could never hurt.
Yeah,
I tried something. I sent him something too, so I'm on that boat.
Yeah, just as a little side tangent, have you guys had any luck with Ural? Like, I've gotten smashed by Ural, but I've never been able to really smash people with Ural myself.
He's given me many sad faces.
Yeah, I don't know whether maybe I just had bad luck with him, or you know, everyone was super prepared for him. But one thing that I wanted to mention about the Voltron deck idea, like once you get past the obvious Voltron guys, there's a bit of pride that you can get from Voltroning like a non-aggressive general, getting that, you know, a general that maybe just generally sits there and doesn't do a whole lot, and making them somehow huge, you know, sort of out of nowhere. That's always a fun thing to do. One example I was thinking of is I have a Glissa Sunseeker deck that's mostly just kind of turns things into artifacts and blows them up. And I got an Umbral Mantle on her and, like, blew up a bunch of artifacts and meanwhile kept untapping her and making her bigger and bigger. And then she was able to swing in once I got rid of the blockers and killed someone with general damage. That was kind of fun.
That is a sweet feeling. Yeah, for sure.
I've built, like, a handful of Voltron decks. Like, not a lot. But I found that, you know, all in all, like, Voltron is a strategy that really suffers from the multiplayer element, I think. Mm-hmm. So the only successful decks I've built that use the Voltron strategy or just like no holds barred, super cutthroat. Like my friend had a really good Ural deck. He still has it, but I mean, to get really competitive, I think you have to go like the Turbo Cataclysm route, which may not be very much fun for the rest of your play group, but it's certainly effective. No one can really argue that. If you just drop Ural and then instead of suiting him up like most decks do, if you just like blow up everyone's lands, that makes him pretty hard to stop.
True that.
I've gotten beaten by Ural a lot. I've never I've never really wanted to make one because he just was kicking my butt so hard. It's kind of the same thing with Zera too. They're just play against those decks a few times and I never want to see them again on the table. I do like that idea though of building Voltron out of commanders that have no business being Voltron. That sounds pretty awesome actually. I think I might have to try that out. The other guy that I've seen recently in my playgroup was actually the Lord of Tressorhorn, who's 10-4 on 4, and he has a bunch of like stupid, you know, come into play effects and stuff. But I think there's a lot of potential to make a really cool Voltron deck out of the Lord of Tressorhorn. So if anyone wants to take up that banner, that would be awesome. I would definitely love to see that.
That would be an excellent entourage segment, which we will do in the future. That's a great idea. Okay, right, so we've gone over like the general principles of the Voltron deck, like how it works, why you build it, and why you play it. So, Donovan, you were mentioning that you feel like that it's weakened by the multiplayer environment, because obviously there's multiple life totals to attack. I think that has it in common with just general aggro decks. One thing I found, though, that works with these aggro decks is that if you're playing in a more seasoned playgroup, a lot of the time, once you start going after one person, like you have to focus the resource of general damage, unless you can realistically expect like one shot a bunch of people at the table. So a lot of the time they'll leave you alone because they expect you to take another player out of the game. And I think that the higher your group's overall like threat evaluation and skill threshold is in the game, I think it actually improves the viability of these decks overall, because in newer groups, a lot of the time people just see, oh shit, that guy can, you know, hurt me really badly, regardless of whether there's a trend of it attacking them or not, and they'll just remove it, just out of fear. Whereas I find that players have been playing for a little while longer, especially if they're more familiar with one another personally, you can gamble a little bit more. So in more seasoned playgroups, as well, there tends to be more powerful decks in general going around. You tend to see more fast combo decks, disruption decks, and lock decks. The Voltron deck is the most obvious threat there is. Whereas in groups where you have to deal with a bunch of different threats, I think it's a little bit easier to get away with a Voltron general.
It's actually kind of funny that you mentioned that, because, you know, I play Ruhan and he kind of takes away a lot of the choice and focusing and so forth. So it actually kind of brings a different dynamic to the table, because even if you're my friend, you know, Ruhan might come at you anyways, you know, and I can't do anything about it. That's just the nature of the beast. So it's kind of like the opposite of almost what you just said with that deck, because everyone kind of knows that they might not get attacked, but it is a possibility that they'll be facing Ruhan with like an Inquisitor's Flail or something. And
jeez.
Yeah, give him unblockable with that thing and he's a two-turn clock. So
I'm curious, Ruhan, I wanted to ask you about that, because when that first came out, I was really fascinated by the political implications of playing that guy, and I haven't had a chance to actually play him myself. So how do you deal with a guy playing Ruhan? Like, you know what I mean?
Oh, like how do we fight against it, or how does Cassidy play it?
Well, I'm just curious as to how the table reacts to it.
Oh, we all, honestly, in my group, we all just sit around going, Ruhan smash! And talking about how he has, like, he's just did a line of coke, and he's using, like, a Locks on Warhammer in one hand and a hooker in the other one, and just going crazy on everybody. Pretty great.
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, to make the deck viable in multiplayer, I had to put, like, a lot more, like, effort into making it good. So, kind of like, so, like, the whole political thing about him attacking randomly kind of, like, is balanced by the fact that, like, I'm casting, like, Distortion Strike and stuff like that on him to make him unblockable. So, I mean, like, I don't know who he's going to attack, but he's going to be doing damage. So it's kind of like, when the deck was in its infant stage, it was, multiplayer was awful, because usually you just get me off the field before I do anything, because obviously it's an easy target, but just because of all the good cards I've been putting in, just the focus I have on getting him out fast and making it so he kills really quickly, it's kind of like, it kind of just functions basically as a normal deck, honestly, lately. And it's just kind of like, oh yeah, that guy's attacking for a lot of damage. Let's deal with it like any other big fatty that's bearing down. So really, it really hasn't changed. Or I guess it's just kind of a normal deck at this point.
It's funny that you mention it that way, actually, because this is something I also wanted to discuss. Voltron decks are typically associated with very fast-moving decks that play the general, it's usually a low-cost guy that can develop high power quickly through some boost, like Rafik of the Many. But there's also, personally, I consider them like at least a facet of the aggro decks, the ones that play their general and use them in a Voltronish fashion, but not necessarily quickly. A lot of the time you see, I would say kind of like Voltron control decks that will play their general later in the game, and they still follow that kind of methodology of suiting them up with various pieces, but they tend to be more defensive in nature. Like, whereas Rafik deck might play something like Imperial Plate to boost his power, one of these decks that using their general as a Voltron finisher would rather use something like Darksteel Plate to keep them alive longer and just provide a steady clock to opponents that have been controlled through most of the game. The resources are down, and now they just need a consistent way to finish them off. And the general provides a unique resource to those decks that wish to pursue that route, obviously just because of the nature of the command zone. You can consistently get this card back, even if your opponents manage to destroy it.
Right, and to me, that's honestly one of the most fascinating things about the Voltron archetype. I know when we were talking about your Savra deck, I was saying how Savra lets you skimp on removal because, you know, she herself is removal, and then that lets your deck focus more on, like, assembling some kind of incremental advantage engine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think with the Voltron archetypes, that lets you skimp on win conditions and focus more on, like, just getting rid of your, like, answers to your opponent's stuff and clearing the way for your win con, because you always have access to your win con from the start. You don't necessarily need to devote any more deck slots to.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking kind of Skithrix when you brought that up, because not only is he he's in a pretty good control color anyways with black, but, you know, he's actually a lot faster than even the 21 damage. So, like, I've noticed that you can really kind of drag out the game with Skithrix and wipe the table pretty fast. And there's also those sweet equipment that boost based on swamps.
Oh, those are so baller.
Right. And, yeah. And also, they don't even... one of them requires life to... Yeah, they both do. One Nightmare Lash is, like, 3 life to equip, and then the other one is the Lash Wraith from New Phyrexian, and that's Phyrexian mana. So basically, you can put both these massive beater equipment on him for no investment of mana, and he gets haste. So, you know, he can pretty much kill the turn he comes into play.
And so, regeneration, too, so he's pretty resilient to most threats.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I think also Xur kind of falls into that category, too, because he's just so versatile that you can grab all those sweet 3 CMC enchantments and just, you know, lock down the board, especially in those colors. Tons of really good enchantments, 3 and under.
I was just thinking about Ruhan, and, like, if somebody's playing Ruhan at the table, it really makes, and it could be any Voltron archetype, I guess, other than, like, Ural or Xur, who might make himself hard to target, but like the vows from the Commander product,
mm-hmm.
like Vow of Duty and stuff like that. I mean, how great would it be to slap a vow on someone else's Ruhan? You can just kind of sit back and enjoy the enjoy the random show, knowing he's not coming at you.
Oh, I've seen it done and done it personally many times, and it's pretty great. yeah, you can't really be too mad about it.
Right.
But that's a good segue though, because next we've gone over the strengths, we've gone over the various ways you can play these generals. Let's talk weaknesses here. Now, we went over Tuck, and obviously that's, like, the worst-case scenario. Like, I think we can agree that's the worst thing that can probably happen, especially
yeah.
one of the ones that doesn't even let it hit the board, like Hinder or Spell Crumple. Because then many generals that are Voltron-y in nature, Voltron-y, new word, they let you sacrifice your general. And a lot of people have onboard sack outlets like High Market Phyrexian Arena, sorry, Phyrexian Tower, to get rid of them quickly in the event, like, they need that emergency escape valve for their commander. To just slide them back into the command zone. But with the counter spells, you don't even get that opportunity. So that's definitely the worst thing that can happen to your deck. And I think that's obviously why people play with those spells. They're made so much better in Commander by the fact that you can tuck these generals. But what are some of these other weaknesses that you guys tend to see among these decks with, like, a common thread?
Well, just speaking from personal experience, just the other day I played a game with Ruhan, and he had been killed, like, 6 times at this point, and I just, like, was having trouble getting the mana to cast him. And, you know, since the deck is linear, it basically was a lot like him being tucked. You know, I can't, you know, I have no access to him anymore. So that's also the other big flaw, is if there's enough removal, enough answers for him, for any Voltron general, eventually it's going to become unfeasible to actually cast them and win with them, and therefore your whole strategy is kind of shot.
Yeah, to play off what Donovan was talking about earlier, in that same vein, because these decks tend to go a little bit lighter on the game-ending threats, because they generally can expect the commander to be there, if they don't have a way to access their general, a lot of the time they literally have no other win condition, or they have very few that are reliable, especially if you're in a position of even moderate strength, they can't find something that's going to be a real solid finisher. I know I've definitely used Bitter Ordeal more than a few times to go after the Voltron guy, and then just pick through his deck and pick out, like, his 4 dangerous cards that aren't his commander, just to basically know that if I can get rid of his commander on a routine basis with something like Savra, he's impotent. right? Like, maybe he literally can't beat me at that point. Sometimes they definitely can't anymore. So a lot of the time, if you have enough removal and you can take care of their commander, or if you can lock their commander down somehow, even something like simple, like Icy Manipulator for a while, a lot of the time you can really just nullify that whole deck and not have to worry about them too much. Not them killing you anyway.
One thing I was just thinking about, a pet card of mine that I really like that I think could be a nice kind of rattlesnake card for the Voltron player would be, you know, like Tower of the Magistrate, which if they're using a bunch of equipment to Voltron up, you can just leave the tower out ready to activate and they can't attack you, or else you'll just sort of unequip them at instant speed.
Yeah, that's another valid way to go after these decks, though, is that instead of, because a lot of the times the commander itself can be a little bit smallish, like Xur. So if you just hose what they use to Voltron him up, so to speak, then it's almost as good a lot of the time.
Yep.
And things like Back to Nature or Shatterstorm, like those are great answers against these kind of decks.
Also, the mazes, too, which can slot into any deck, are kind of detrimental, too.
Oh, yeah. They're really common, too.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you don't have Hexproof or Shroud on your general, you pretty much don't have much of a chance with a Voltron deck anymore. I can't think of really any creatures that have protection from lands, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, one other card type that really hoses these guys, you don't see it quite as much as stuff like Mazavith and Tuck. But anything like Bates Fetters or Pacifism, man, if you get one of those stuck on your general and you can't get rid of it, like, I mean, it's pretty much done. You might as well have gotten it shuffled into your deck somewhere.
Actually, that's interesting, because that's something I definitely see underexplored, is the use of those kind of pacifism effects. I see Face Fetters and Prison Term, but those are really the only two. And I think things like Cage of Hands, we talked about it on the Popper cast, but then I started employing it in some regular decks. And it's been pretty effective, because people just don't expect to see that kind of removal. Stuff like Shackles, even. People just don't.
Yeah.
People just don't think that enchantment-based removal that's typically associated with limited games is going to spring up as much, and then oftentimes they don't really have great answers for it. At the very least, you get like a one-for-one if they burn an enchant removal or artifact removal on it, but yeah, those are actually quite good when it comes to dealing with Voltron Generals, and I think that's kind of an interesting facet of these decks. They're really the only targets that you really want to throw those on too regularly. Otherwise, kind of it can be a little bit embarrassing to play a vanilla pacifism in Commander.
Also, the Gwatha Hazeed too. He's been really obnoxious.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah, if you can't kill that guy, it's pretty much lights out.
Vanilla ice. Right? So that's it for our archetype rundown on Voltron decks. We will have a link to Cassidy's Wuhan deck in the show notes, since we've been talking about that a lot. I'm sure there's going to be some interest in it. But as always, if you have your own thoughts or experiences on Voltron decks, and I know some of you do, feel free to send those in. The contact information will be in the show notes, as always. But that's it for the Archetype Rundown this week. Next, we're going to move into we're going to take a different tack here. We're going to be talking about the Arch Enemy Survival Handbook and how you can survive being the one guy at the table that everyone's going to get. This segment right here is going to be the Arch Enemy Survival Handbook. Like I was talking about before the break there, we're going to be going over some strategies that will help you survive if you're the one player at the table that everyone's gunning for. Often this is the player that's in the dominant position, or a player that's run away in the early game with things that look scary, like crazy mana acceleration, but then they realize, oh shit, I have no way to actually use all this mana and win the game. And this is not the same as being that guy, which is something that we talked about earlier, because that guy is generally the guy that's gunned for regardless of what he's doing or what kind of position he's in. And that's normally associated with either like a social stigma, being a really good player, or having a generally stronger deck than the other players. What we're talking about here can happen to anybody. It just means you're in the dominant position generally at the table, you're kind of overpowering the other players, and then they kind of have to band together like the scrubs they are to deal with you. So we're going to go over some ways that you can hinder them, finish them off quick, and in general we're just going to look at ways that either you can avoid the perception of being in control, or ways that you can just actually be in control of the whole table, the kind of decks that lend themselves well to this full game control. And I think that to kick things off here, I mentioned Runaway Acceleration earlier. I think that's probably the worst way to get into the Arch Enemy position. In the early game, unless you're going to win like immediately, like with a big Death Cloud or something similar, just belching out all your mana acceleration as quickly as you can is a great way to turn everyone against you, regardless of what you're actually planning to do with it, because it just looks scary as shit.
Yeah, that'll definitely make some enemies really quick if you get, like, way out of hand with the mana ramping. As far as avoiding this kind of thing goes, I find that combo is probably one of the stronger archetypes in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's not always obvious when someone's about to combo off. There are signs, but they're a lot more subtle than just like vomiting all your lands onto the table, you know? So usually a combo deck can just kind of come out of nowhere and just win on the spot if no one can interact with them.
Actually, I kind of attack it in a different way by holding back threats, and you know, even if I can not necessarily win, but really advance the board, I'll hold back. I've talked about it a little bit before on the podcast. How I kind of like to just kind of lessen my power and just kind of go off in one turn, kind of like what you were saying, Donovan. Especially like with my Omnath deck, because everyone expects me to ramp up right away. If you don't ramp up with like a green deck that everyone expects to, it actually kind of goes on the opposite favor of where you're even less scary than maybe everyone else's deck is. So like the fainting ramp and things like that can also play into kind of the same idea where you might have the most powerful advantage on the board, but you don't necessarily have to show it to the other players. And that's probably the best way to get around like being targeted right away, just because of your general or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned, Andy, about, you know, mana acceleration. Like I have a Damia Sage of Stone deck, and the first time I played it, I like had by like say the third turn, I had Exploration, Carpet of Flowers, and Burgeoning in play.
That'll raise some eyebrows.
Wow! Like I cast Damia probably like on turn 3 or 4 with all that craziness going on, and of course, everybody flipped out, but I had literally nothing else. All I had was that, you know, and some lands to play out. And the rest of the game, I was basically on a back foot while people were just gunning for me. And I was trying to dig into something good, and it made me realize that I had not built a deck to take advantage of that type of start.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I basically was just sort of, you know, wanting to put a lot of cheap stuff in my Damia deck and play it out quickly and just keep drawing without really thinking about how I was going to take advantage of all that. And like I had a buddy of mine who was like, dude, if I had, you know, 10 mana out on turn 5 in Damia, I would have killed everybody, you know. And I'm like, just having fun drawing cards and playing little small spells.
Yeah, but that's a very easy thing to say as well. I think that's a common trap that people fall into, is like, oh, well, he has X mana, we must all be dead. Like, you have to remember they have to actually have a spell in hand to use all that mana, right?
Right.
How many, realistically, how many cards are there that need that much mana?
Yeah.
Like, there's really not that many. But yeah, I think that the out-of-control ramp is the easiest way to get into this position. Now, if you are in this position, I think the out-of-control ramp combined with draw, which Damia does provide you with, actually lets you win from that standpoint. And I've been seeing a lot of bug decks that do that. Like, they play a lot of lands. Like, Scotty Mack, he plays a Damia deck as well. It's pretty common for it to have a lot of lands in play really early. But then sometimes, you know, everyone's scared because he's got so many lands, and then he plays Damia, refill his hand, but everyone just destroys it the second they see it. So he ends up just top decking for like half of the game. And by the time that he's able to play Damia and draw some cards, everyone's caught up. So that's one thing you do have to be wary about. If you're planning to like go all in off the hop, you better have a real win condition in hand that lets you either oppress the rest of the table to the point where they can't come back and beat you down. Or you need to have like an on-the-spot game ender, like Death Cloud is my personal favorite because no one likes it, so of course I'm going to love it. But it's that, I think, is one of the best examples of like just shoveling dirt onto the casket is Death Cloud. There really is not a card that's more demoralizing and also actually debilitating than a big Death Cloud early in the game.
I've shelved my Damia deck thinking of what I needed to do to it, so I think Death Cloud might end up going into that deck.
Yes, do it! Yes. Eldrazi, another great example of the kind of cards that will just bury a player completely if you're going to use this breakaway strategy. But enough with our mana ramp strategies. Another strategy that very commonly gets into the situation of the Arch Enemy thing is the lock deck. Lock decks that require pieces on the table, they're visible, their effect on the game is kind of tactile at that point, and everyone can perceive that they're hurting them and slowing them down, making them unpleasant. What are some ways that those kind of decks can avoid just getting the shit smacked at them? Like, we talked about them last week. Everyone knows I have a blistering passion for destroying these decks on site, but I have no idea how to play one because I've never really gone through the motions of it. Let's say you're playing a deck like that very commonly has a global effect on the board, one that will make everyone unhappy all at the same time. What's a way that you can deploy that kind of strategy and be successful instead of deploying it and then whining when it doesn't work? Becoming a salt truck, as it were.
That one's a lot tougher to kind of mask because it's usually the general that makes it, you know, especially now that Arayo's banned, I guess it's not as big of a deal. But whenever I see a Teferi deck, I automatically think that there is a possibility that they're going to do some stupid six to cast artifact and lock us out of the game, you know.
That's always a thrill, isn't it?
Right. And then when I'm playing my own, like, kind of prison decks, like the Stax decks that I kind of play, it's pretty tough to, like, to not get the ire of the table. Pretty much the only thing you can do is just try to lock everyone down before they get mad enough. Or if you're playing with a lot of other decks that are really good, sometimes the fact that you have a prison deck is overshadowed by the fact that there's a Ural deck on the table, you know? So, like, there's a lot of that that can come into it, too. But in general, playing a prison and people knowing that you have a prison deck is, in my experience, very tough to, like, to be like, come on, just let me play, guys. You know? No thank you, bye, prison deck. That's pretty much how my experience has been.
You know, now that I think about it, I think my Pauper Child of Valara deck is actually a prison deck. Because all it wants to do is, like, maneuver itself into a position where it can just kind of, like, lock everyone else out of the game with, like, Capsize or Child of Valara or whatever. And so, to that extent, I think probably the most successful thing a lock deck has in its arsenal is politics. And it's really hard for, like, a blatant lock deck to just politic its way to any kind of advantage. But by knowing when to make your move, knowing when to actually play Death Cloud or Smokestack, instead of just, like, powering it out there, you can really maximize its effect and just end the game instead of, like, dragging it out longer and longer and longer. Even though your ultimate ideology is, you know, if your opponents can complain, you're not strangling hard enough.
Well played. Yes. Good point. That's a great segue, actually, though, into the political spectrum of things, because the next thing I want to talk about is if you're in this arc enemy position, regardless of what kind of strategy you're playing, everyone's coming at you. How important are these meta strategy tools that you have? And I'm referring to things like Don was talking about, like the politicking, the bluffing, the redirecting, you know, threatening your other your friends' families, things like that. Like, how important are those things to making sure that you can remain in this kind of tyrant position until the game actually ends and you come out on top? Because the biggest one for me is the misdirection. If it's not too overt that I'm winning and stomping everyone to the ground, I'll just tell people all the time, like, "Oh, are you really going to point a removal spell at my thing? Like, for real, son? Like, what are you thinking? Okay, whatever, you know." And then sometimes they just feel so bad about it because I've, you know, been really rude that they'll start directing their attention elsewhere. And it doesn't do you any wonders socially, but man, will you win those games.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine, Josh, that I've played multiplayer Magic with for years and years and years, and he is a master of getting everyone riled up over other people.
Yeah.
When he has blatantly, I mean, he's sitting there playing his Xur deck or, you know, something crazy that you know spells trouble. And he loves combo. He combo kills the table, like, every time. All his decks basically do that. And yet somehow, you know, he gets people riled up over something that I'm playing or something that the new kid at the table's playing, and everyone starts gunning, you know, and I'm always, like, raising my hands going, "What about Josh?"
But that's a great point, too, is the ability to, like, kind of rally the troops at the table just to make them do what you want. Sometimes it's hard to do when you're actually in the position of strength. But another important thing is playing permanents that don't necessarily apply pressure, like a Lord of Extinction does, or a Ural with a bunch of auras on it do. Instead, you're playing things like Rings of Brighter and stuff like that that are proven awesome cards that have a huge impact. But, I'm not doing anything with it right now, guys, you know. So even though you're actually winning, maybe you can make it look like someone else is winning. And the other thing is, like you mentioned, the new kid, Fear of the Unknown. Oh, my goodness, just leverage that till the day you die. Like, guys, we don't know what this deck could be doing. It could be doing anything. You know, like, hushed tones are important, pass notes, that kind of stuff. It's a very political game for me. I like to think I'm the Henry Kissinger of this shit.
Yeah, like, this guy Josh, like, one time I was playing, and I had, like, turn one Soul Ring into Skull Clamp. But I was mana hosed, and, like, I spent the rest of the game, like, with nothing but those two cards and, like, an occasional, like, one creature I could play, and then I would clamp it to death to hopefully draw out of my mana screw. And I wasn't drawing anything, and, of course, he was rallying the troops, saying, you gotta get rid of Benny before, you know, he pulls out of it, you know. And I'm,
you guys remember what Skull Clamp did to Standard? My God.
So I eventually, in frustration, I threw my hand down on the table and said, look, I have nothing. Leave me alone.
I mean, that's assholes like me that say that when they're winning that make that not work.
That was like literally the only way I could get the people to stop worrying about me and start worrying about people that were actually, you know, progressing their game state. So it was kind of extreme, but it stood out in my mind. Everyone kind of laughed at me when I
was actually kind of thinking more the opposite, where you kind of you just act really cool. You know what I mean? Like,
just like play it low.
Yeah, exactly. And just like kind of don't be a douche too often. And also when it comes to like decks that are blatantly obnoxious, you can just not play it very often, and then like people's threshold for it will like generally be okay, because they'll know that they're only going to get locked down for one game, you know, and then you're going to shelve it and get something else to play with. So, and also playing dumb, I think, helps a lot, kind of along the same lines as misdirection. You know, it kind of plays into how I am anyways. But
nice.
You know, it's just just act like you don't really know what's going on sometimes.
Just sit there and start acting like you're derping it up.
Yeah, even reading your opponent's cards when you know what they do, and kind of being like, oh yeah, that is pretty good, that kind of thing.
Oh, that's you're a slime ball. Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, you know, if I really don't want to be attacked, or there's the perception that I'm doing something when I'm not, you know, you gotta misdirect somehow, as you mentioned. So that's one way to do it, is just to totally act like you don't know what you're doing until you win.
But, yeah, see, I think me and Cassie are both the guys that throw sand in your eyes in a fight after you're like, oh no, don't hit me, I'm allergic to punches, you know. Pretty nasty.
Yeah, win the fight, right? You don't want to get your butt kicked, all right.
Oh man, I just go straight for the groin and bounce. I think there were at least some good tips buried in that there. So there's our Arch Enemy Survival Handbook. If you can filter your way through our real-life fighting advice and talking about threatening families, I'm sure you found some outstanding advice for surviving when you're ahead of the table. But that's it for strategy this week. Next, we're going to move into technology, and we're going to be talking about Warhorses, which are the kind of go-to combos or engines that we like to include in our decks.
For the first segment in technology here, we're going to talk about Warhorse combos and just value engines that we all like to use, and maybe just kind of bring awareness to them. A lot of people have suggested that that we show our favorite combos and kind of go over the interactions. Basically, we're going to lay out how they work, how they interact, and, you know, basically where we use them and why we love them. My first one basically is going to be Mana Reflection plus the untap artifacts like Grim Monolith and Basalt Monolith and Mana Vault to a lesser extent. The first one I mentioned was Mana Reflection, which is a 6 to cast enchantment, 4 colorless and 2 green. And it reads basically, if you tap a permanent for mana, it produces twice as much of that mana instead. It's definitely the best mana doubler available. And then the other one, I'll just read off Grim Monolith, because that's the coolest one. So Grim Monolith is a 2 to cast artifact. It does not untap during your untap phase. It taps to add 3 colorless mana to your mana pool as a mana source. And you can pay 4 colorless to untap Grim Monolith. So, you know, like I mentioned, you just tap it for 6 with the Mana Reflection in play, pay 4 to untap it, and rinse and repeat, basically. Just keep going until you Genesis Wave for a lot, or Exsanguinate, or, you know, whatever you want to do. I use that in my Omnath deck whenever I go to tournaments, or, you know, whenever this prize is on the line, just so that I can get that extra boost of mana. And it's pretty good with Kamal Fist of Croza, too, because it makes his ability a lot easier to activate.
Yeah, that's a very popular one, I think, just because the pieces themselves are fine as well, like independently, which I think is a cornerstone for any of these kind of go-to combos that are going to work in a variety of decks. The strength of the cards unto themselves is fine. There's a lot of cards that rely on kind of, you know, other very conditional situations to be created to reach their full potential, where there's no shame in playing any of those cards individually, and that's something I think you're going to see as a theme for these as well. It's pretty modal. Like, that's easy to splash in non-mono green decks as well. especially given that one of the pieces is always an artifact, so that helps. So, yeah, the first combo that I have here that I put into quite a few decks is Perilous Forays in conjunction with Bloodghast. Rampaging Baelos works fine as a substitution for Bloodghast, or really any creature that will repeatedly turn itself from the graveyard, but Bloodghast is ideal. Perilous Forays is an enchantment. It was an uncommon printed in Ravnica. It costs 3 colorless mana and 2 green mana, and the text is you can pay 1 mana and sacrifice a creature, search your library for a land card with a basic land type and put it onto the battlefield tapped, and then shuffle your library. And then Bloodghast, it's your favorite Spirit Fingers vampire. He's double black for a 2-1 rare from Zendikar. He's a vampire spirit. Bloodghast can't block. He's got haste when somebody has less than 10 life. And the landfall ability he has is whenever a land comes into the battlefield under your control, you can bring him back from the graveyard to the battlefield directly. So it's pretty awesome. For every 1 colorless that you spend, Bloodghast hits the shitter. You put a land into play tapped, and he comes back. So for every untapped land, basically you can go and get a land from your library. Now, it's important to note Perilous Forays is a basic land type, not a basic land, so you can actually get your duels with it, which is fantastic. But in general, I find it's a relatively stable combo, and in the kind of decks that run these cards, there's no reason not to use them. They're very solid. Perilous Forays is a great sacrifice outlet. Out of all sacrifice outlets, I think it's one of the ones that every time that you use it, you get the longest lasting impact. A lot of sacrifice cards lead to temporary benefits like pumps or short-term mana that you have to use by the end of the phase, whereas this leads to an actual investment in your board state. So that alone makes it worth using. With Bloodghast, it's just off the chain, straight up. Like, you can't hate on this shit. Look at him. He's a vampire spirit. How many of those are out there, especially with the spirit fingers? So, yeah, it just works. It builds off so many other synergies. There's so many things you can do when your guys are going to the graveyard, when you're bringing them back into play. You can get the other landfall cards involved. So it's a very easy to slot into other decks kind of combo where the individual pieces are fine, and I think that's why I like it so much. Mind you, with a Savr deck, it's totally off the chain. But I put it into pretty much all my black-green combination decks that I can, even though I don't have a whole lot of those. But enough of my rambling about my combo here. Let's take it over to Benny so his mustached magnificence can explain what he's slotting into all his decks.
Well, I find that I put Nim Deathmantle into all my decks that have creatures, which is basically all my decks. Well, I'll read it real quick. It's a 2-mana artifact equipment, and it equips for 4, and its equipped creature gets +2/+2, has Intimidate, and is a black zombie, and which is pretty cool package of abilities on its surface there. But what the really cool part about it is the next part, which says whenever a non-token creature is put into your graveyard from the battlefield, you may pay 4. If you do, return that card to the battlefield and attach Nim Deathmantle to it. So basically, if you have enough mana out there, Nim Deathmantle can save your favorite creature or multiple creatures from pesky Wrath of God and other early demise spells around there. And what I typically set this aside right next to my Seedborn Muses because Nim Deathmantle is very mana intensive. So Seedborn Muse, which I'm sure most people are very familiar with.
One of your favorite cards, my understanding of this.
Seedborn Muse is a card that I love and I hate, I have to say. But let me read it for those of you who may not know. But it is a 2/4 green creature for 2 green and 3 colorless mana. It's a spirit, and the rules text says, untap all permanents you control during each other player's untap step. One of my golden rules of Commander is he who controls the Seedborn Muse the longest wins the game. Gaining basically another turn during each other player's turn to use all of your mana and all your creatures and that tap to do stuff and all your artifacts that tap to do stuff is pretty broken. But, you know, since you are untapping all your lands every player's up untap step, Nim Deathmantle just becomes that much more of a protection for your creatures. If I'm playing green, I've got Seedborn Muse in it, and I've got Nim Deathmantle in there. I would highly recommend anyone that hasn't given Nim Deathmantle a try to give it a run. It's a pretty sweet card.
Actually, I was going to do a Seedborn Muse combo too, but it was Vedalken Orrery, or however you say that weird word. it's you know, not only do you get to untap, but you get to play your opponent's turns with them, basically.
So oh,
it's kind of like as close as green can get to like a time walk by itself. I definitely use that as the way to finish off with Omnath because, you know, it doesn't take very long with Seedborn Muse to make him gigantic in basically one round of turns. So definitely the orrery with Seedborn, and I'm with you that Seedborn is both awesome and also super nefarious, sort of.
Yeah.
Oh, that crazy bitch is evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen games where, you know, you play a Seedborn Muse, and then someone clones it, and then someone steals your Seedborn Muse, and then someone kills it, and then someone reanimates it from the graveyard, and, you know, it's like whoever ends up actually keeping the Seedborn Muse out there, they eventually win the game.
I did like, though, Benny, that the fact that you introduced this without introducing two cards, you just were introducing Nim Death Mantle, I was like, you know what? Yeah, it is good enough to just be by itself one of these warhorses. Because Nim Death Mantle plus mana is totally awesome. Like, I can't believe I don't see that deck that card a little bit more. Like, yeah, it's mana intensive, but it's so tasty. Like, why wouldn't you want that taste in your mouth?
Yeah, there's so many ways of really ramping your mana. You know, it's not that onerous to have that Death Mantle out there protecting your favorite creatures. And it's also particularly nice to sometimes turn your creatures black.
Mm-hmm.
That may be something that, you know, like if someone's got fear, you know, a creature with fear that's kicking your ass, being able to make a black zombie in your green deck or your white deck can be helpful.
It's also good with sack outlets and stuff like Yosei, you know, because it's almost kind of like a sort of like a persist that doesn't suck in that way. So that's exactly. Definitely a good way.
All right, well, I guess I'm going to follow suit and also just suggest one card. I think my favorite thing to do in Magic is probably draw cards. Like, I really love drawing cards, and I think I probably have a problem. Because, like, all of my decks are basically just trying to, like, draw lots of cards as quickly as possible. Like, no matter what color I'm in or combination of colors, like, that's pretty much my overall strategy. And to that end, my favorite combo, I guess, is Skull Clamp plus a creature.
Well, that's a good one, though. It's a good combo.
And preferably the creature would have one toughness. In case by some you're like a new Magic player or something, you don't know what Skull Clamp is. This is an artifact. Cost one mana. It costs one to equip and says, when equipped creature is put into a graveyard, draw two cards. Excuse me, when equipped creature dies, draw two cards.
There we go. Let's stay in line here, Donovan.
Yes. I think it originally also gave the equipped creature +1/+1, but that would just be too powerful, so they changed it to +1/-1 to fix that problem.
And I think it did do a handy job of that. If I'm not mistaken, memory serves. Yeah, this card, like, if you ever play it with 1/1, oh my god, it's, wow, it's way OP.
Oh, yeah. But no, like, whether you're skull clamping like a Bloodghast or tokens from a Sacred Mesa or just like maybe your general and letting it go to the graveyard because it's awesome. Like, Skull Clamp is pretty freaking sweet. And I always throw in like Trinket Mage if I'm in blue, throw in Godo if I'm in red, and Godo's basically an overpriced Trinket Mage to go get Skull Clamp. I really love this card.
I think I'm going to go with some cards that aren't necessarily good by themselves, but are really cool when you put them together. It's Mind Crank and Blood Chief Ascension combined together.
Standard legal combo for a little
yes.
while. Yep. Good, good.
So Mind Crank is a 2 to cast artifact from New Phyrexia, and it reads, whenever an opponent loses life, that player puts that many cards from the top of his or her graveyard from the top of his library into his or her graveyard. And then Blood Chief Ascension. So that's a one to cast enchantment from Zendikar. At the beginning of each end step, if an opponent lost two or more life this turn, you may put a quest counter on it. So it's kind of what like in that series of weird quest counter cards. But the important part is whenever a card is put into an opponent's graveyard from anywhere, if Blood Chief Ascension has three or more quest counters on it, you may have that player lose two life. And if they do, you gain two life. But really, when it comes to this combo, it's kind of like a causality loop kind of thing for me, where like it's not only infinite, but it's kind of inevitable, and it keeps getting worse. You know, the first time they get milled, they take two damage, so two more cards get milled. and then they take 4 damage, and then 4 cards get milled, and then so forth. And it basically makes it, as long as this is on the table, anyone who has anything go to their graveyard loses. And I really like it because by themselves, I think that both the cards are kind of lame. I guess Ascension's okay, but Mindcrank is pretty terrible. But when you put them together, it's just a really funny combo. So I've definitely experimented with that in my Damia deck when it was a mill deck, and I pulled it off a few times and took it out, of course. But I really like that interaction, just the way it kind of like cascades and gets huger.
Yeah, we'll have a link in the show notes to this kind of infamous Damia mill deck that Cassie constructed at one point. People still email me and ask about it every now and then, like, oh, can I see that deck? So yeah. I'll go next. My next combo is another one that's really easy to slot into any deck that has blue in its color identity, and you don't even have to disrupt your deck construction much, because most of its lands. It's a 3-card engine. The first piece is Magosi the Water Veil. This is a rare land from Zendikar. It comes to play tapped, then you can tap it to add blue to your mana. You can pay a blue and tap it to put an Eon counter on it, which I think is the only thing that produces Eon counters in Magic. And then you skip your next turn. And then you can tap it and remove the Eon counter and return it to your hand to take another turn. So, unto itself, it's like probably one of the fairest Time Walk effects ever, other than like Wormfang Manta, which isn't very good. But this is a reasonable card, because you're only going to use the Eon counter ability either very early in the game when you think you can afford to just like shit away a turn because you're a little farther ahead, or maybe you're a little farther behind and you can count on politics balancing things out. And then later you can use it as reserve gas if you need like an extra attack step or something. And it's just kind of a cool card to use anyway. You might have one floating around your rare miner. Next card's a little less likely to have one floating around because they're becoming expensive. It's Deserted Temple. This is a rare land from Odyssey. It taps to add a colorless to your mana pool, and you can pay one and tap it to untap target land. Obviously this thing's dynamite with like Cabal Coffers or any of those other ridiculous lands that produce huge amounts of mana. And with Magosi, it produces a very interesting loop when you involve Rings of Rightherd. So how the rings work is it's a rare artifact from Lorwyn. It costs 3 colorless. Whenever you activate an ability, if it isn't a mana ability, you can pay 2 colorless, and if you do, you copy it. You can choose new targets for the copy. So it's a bit of a complicated combo. I believe it costs 6 mana to function at full. But what you have to do is you have the Magosi in play. You have the Deserted Temple, and basically what you're doing is you're copying the Deserted Temple's untap and the Magosi's extra turn ability, both with Rings of Brighthearth. And what that does is it nullifies the turn that you skip to put the Aeon counter on it, and gives you an additional turn. So it produces an infinite turn loop. While many people revile the infinite turn loop, I'm a dick, so I think they're okay. And it just works, because most of the pieces are lands. People tend to have inadequate non-basic land hate, so you can get away with them for a long time. Unless you're a real herp derp, you don't play them unless if your opponents have like strip mines on board, you wait till those are used up or you've destroyed them yourself. And Rings of Brighthearth is a card that raises eyebrows, so generally you only deploy that once you're ready to win. But it's a good card in general, so you don't really have to warp your deck construction at all to include these. Two of them are lands, one produces colored mana, the other one often is a net mana producer when you use things like Ravnica Karuz, so it's a great card anyway. And then the rings is great in almost any deck with an activated ability, especially on the general. Then it becomes off the chain. So if you have these pieces, use them in your decks. It's a good win condition. You can just kind of slot in. It's unobtrusive. And I've spoken about how it's almost impossible for me to make this work anymore because people are so aware of that's how I use it. But if your group isn't, like, just feel free to ambush them and just wreck up some games with this. It's pretty gratifying.
The next card I'd like to talk about is Jorael, Empress of Beasts.
Oh, that's awesome. Already, yes.
This is an oldie but a goodie. I mean, sometimes you can even use her as your general, but any kind of green deck, I think she deserves some consideration. She's a 3/3 for 2 green and 3 colorless, and she's a legendary creature, and her activated ability is 1 green and 2, and you tap her and discard 2 cards from your hand. And then until the end of the turn, all lands target player controls are 3/3 creatures that are still lands. So what I like about her, I mean, I like to play creatures and have them out on the board, and a lot of people like to play creature sweepers and kill all my creatures.
Those bastards.
I know. They like to ruin my fun. So Jorael, basically, if she's out there untapped and she makes them pay for their wrath by making them also wrathing their own lands. So sometimes she'll basically convince somebody maybe not to cast that wrath until they can figure out some way to deal with her, maybe giving me a couple extra turns with her in play. But as far as like a combo with her, I was trying to pull off in my Damia deck, actually. I had Jor-El and Mind Slicer and Noetic Scales. And Noetic Scales is an obscure artifact that's a 4-drop, and it says during each player's upkeep, return to owner's hand each creature that player controls with power greater than the number of cards in his or her hand.
I am familiar with Noetic Scales, and that is devious.
My game plan, which I never was able to really pull together despite drawing a gazillion cards with Damia, was to find whatever player was trying to get ahead on the board to strip everyone's hand with a sacrificed Mind Slicer, and in response turn all their land, activate Jor-El to turn all their lands into creatures during their upkeep, and have them basically bounce all their lands back to their hands.
That's pretty dirty.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. That one's cool.
Although it's funny because Jor-El is a card I've tried to use a couple of times. Generally, it's like it's okay. I never really have a great reason for cutting it in the decks where I do cut it. A lot of times, it's just like it's a different colored deck, and I want to squeeze in some other cards that I've used before. But it's definitely been a very good card for me because, as well, there's no shame in using the ability on yourself to overrun your opponents with your lands once they've been animated.
Yeah,
like, that's a perfectly fine win tactic.
And one thing, too, with the scales, I think I sort of came to appreciate the card a little bit more, realizing that, I mean, people play gigantic creatures in Commander. I mean, that's one of the main thing. And, we talked about the Voltron strategy. Hmm. If a creature is going to be larger than 7, that those scales are going to make them bounce that creature back to their hand, typically. So,
yeah, I've used it in my Rexial deck with all the discard effects, and it's been great. It's been great.
and especially
your own end to reuse your Enter the Battlefield abilities as well.
Yeah, if your general isn't one that's going to get necessarily huge, it might be a card to consider for your deck.
All right, I believe finally we have Donovan here to round out this segment.
Alrighty, well, I talked about my affinity for drawing cards, and my next suggestions, my next war horses, as it were, kind of fall into the same category. I really like draw sevens, and this is everything from like Time Twister to Wheel of Fortune to Jin Gitoxias. But I think people don't play enough of these because they're extremely good, and I think people forget a lot about them. And just depending on the kind of deck I'm playing, you throw different draw sevens in the deck. Like,
it's not a question of whether I'm going to use them, just which draw sevens do I select.
Now you're catching on.
Like, I'm imagining a binder page just laden with draw sevens, like those cheesy scenes where they open the closet and it's full of weapons, but Donovan's is big draw seven.
Right.
I mean, a memory
jar in every deck, right?
I think now you're starting to get the picture of like how I build EDH decks. But like, if I'm playing a graveyard-centric deck, then I usually like to throw in, like, Memory Jar or Wheel of Fortune or Jin Gitoxias or something, or maybe Windfall, stuff that stocks your graveyard while also refilling your hand. A lot of times, other decks, like, they don't care that much about the graveyard, and you find that you might need some more graveyard hate, so then, well, let's play, like, Time Spiral or Time Reversal or, heck, even, like, Diminishing Returns is pretty solid. I don't think people play these cards enough. They're exceptionally good, and they can really draw you out of a rut, or they can screw over people's like hand sculpting. You can just like ramp tons of mana and then like refill your hand while everyone else doesn't get very much actual card advantage out of it. They're extremely good, and they're a lot of fun to play.
Okay, that's it for our War Horses segment, where we're going over cards that we commonly include in decks just because they're overall good, and maybe you could as well. I'm sure I'll get some War Horses from you guys if you send them in. The contact information will be in the show notes. Do send them in, because these are the kind of segments where I like to see what you guys are using so I can co-opt them for my own decks and beat up my friends with them. But that's it for War Horses. Next, we're going to go on to our next hands-on set review, where we're going to go over M12. Uh-huh.
For our next technology segment, we are going to do a hands-on set review on M12, which has been out long enough for all of us to give some cards a try in our EDH decks. We have some varying opinions on M12 here, so I guess I'll kick it off with a positive note. I think M12 is chock full of all kinds of great cards. Of course, Swiftfoot Boots is a card that I think popped out to any good EDHer, since one of our instincts is to try to protect our general. Given an artifact that can give him hexproof is pretty sweet. And the haste ability, I mean, it just seems like a perfect combination of abilities on a fairly cheap piece of equipment that I think is pretty cool. I thought Druidic Satchel is kind of a cool card. The artifact that can go in any deck can provide a little bit of land acceleration or some token creatures, which can always be helpful. Yeah, I think it's an interesting bit of utility that can go in decks that might not otherwise have that type of ability. Also, Manalith is a good, mana fixer. I mean, it's not as good as Darksteel Ingot, but once you've got your Darksteel Ingot in there, if you still need some mana fixing for your 3 or 5 color deck, Manalith seems like a pretty good thing. I thought that the Grand Abolisher is kind of cool. Just a decent little 2/2 creature that lets you do, have your turn unmolested, which I think is pretty sweet.
You know what? Yeah, those are all. Yeah, I guess I can't really argue. There wasn't a whole lot in this set that personally appealed to me. Like, I maybe I'm just jaded, but the only cards that I really used from it were Runescarred Demon and that new Sphinx. I have no idea how that's pronounced, so I'm not going to try. So I'm going to call it the Factor Fiction Sphinx. That's what it is. That's what I call it when I play it. And everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say that. So yeah, it's gotta be pretty good. The Runescarred Demon is fucking awesome, though.
Yeah, he's excellent.
That guy's pretty whoop ass. In terms of other really solid kind of commander goodies, the big thing I found was there were a lot of reprints here. There were good cards, certainly, like Oblivion Ring is good. The Titans are quite good. But there wasn't a whole lot of new stuff here that really grabbed my fancy. Like I said, the Sphinx and Runescarred Demon were both awesome. I like Warstorm Surge. I think that was good too, and Buried Ruin is something I see in a lot of commander decks now.
You mentioned the Titans. I think that's one of the biggest reasons I don't like M12, is because Primeval Titan was kind of like always this kind of corner case card that was just almost too good. But now that he's cheap and in two sets, it's kind of like he's got the go ahead from the guys at Wizards of the Coast. And I was kind of a little bummed when they reprinted the Titans. I don't know. But when it comes to the cards that I do like, I actually like the Throne of Emperors, or Throne of Empires, I guess it is, which, puts token creatures into play for any color. And it's not, painful. It's not like Bitter Blossom where you lose life. It's just straight up, pay a little mana, get a little bit of tokens. And those can go a long way in decks that normally don't get token generation. But besides that, most of the cards I liked, you guys already mentioned, so...
I actually have some mixed feelings about the Empire's trilogy.
I like referring to it as a trilogy. That's totally ballin'.
Well, they're cool, and when you look at them, you're like, man, I got to get all the Empire's cards, I got to get them all. But you're playing a singleton 100-card deck, so the chances of trying to, what you got to jump through to get those three together, and then when you get them together, I mean... They're nice, but they're not worth all that trouble, So it's kind of, I know it's probably made more for people that play, 60-card casual kitchen table Magic, and, they'll play four of each in their decks. But for Commander, I was a bit, I was kind of at first thinking it was the second coming of the Cauldra when you get those three together, awesome things happen.
Yeah, it's pretty much whoop-ass time when those actually get popping.
But they're cool little pieces of equipment. I just I was kind of hoping maybe that Wizards could have pushed them maybe just a little bit more.
All right. Well, I mean, I think M12 did bring some goodies. I guess I'll start with the bad news first. I think my biggest disappointment was that a lot of the new cool stuff, because there is some new cool stuff, but it was all at the rare and mythic slots. It didn't bring many like common and uncommon format staples. Like I really enjoy it when they come out with new stuff like Oblivion Ring and reassembling skeletons. Like, man, these effects are pretty like basic, I guess, but they're super useful for like deck building to keep in mind. They're really easy to acquire. But with that said, I guess the cards I really like, I mean, of course, I really love Jace's Archivist. I mean, this guy's like Windfall on a stick.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I bet you saw that and went into conniptions.
Yeah, I was pretty happy. I was like, dang, if I can get this guy with like a Mind Over Matter, I will be set. But like, I also really like the new Chandra. I haven't got like a lot of opportunities to play her, but I mean, she's fun and she's easily castable. And like her ultimate is Inferno. Like a targeted Inferno, so that's like incredible. That sold it for me. I guess the last card that really piques my interest is Vengeful Pharaoh. I love cards that you can like mill yourself and then they come back with some kind of advantage, or like you can pitch to Survival of the Fittest. Like Vengeful Pharaoh is just pretty sweet in that regard. He's a good rattlesnake, and he just keeps coming back as like discard fodder or like an attacker or something. I really like it.
Something cool that happened with the Vengeful Pharaoh is my brother paired it with a Mind Shrieker and basically went ahead to destroy all my attacking creatures when I wasn't paying attention. So it was pretty cool. And now that you mentioned the Planeswalker, I guess I did forget to mention Primal, Guruk Primal Hunter, which, you know, I play Omnath, and him and Omnath are like best buddies. So definitely the Planeswalkers are the top of the card pool there, and it's kind of like what you mentioned though, like they're mythic, you know, so they're really hard to get, and they're still cost prohibitive and stuff. So I definitely agree that M12 was like kind of a bomb set. That's how it was in limited too. It was kind of whatever awesome mythic or rare that you get, and that's pretty much how the whole tournament goes down.
The whoop-de-doo.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, in contrast to Donovan, the card I liked the most out of the whole set was an uncommon. It was Hunter's Insight. It's two colorless and a green, and it's an instant. Choose target creature you control. Whenever that creature deals combat damage to a player or planeswalker this turn, draw that many cards. So I thought that was pretty awesome. It gives green some more card draw that it really doesn't need because it already has too much, but it's easily splashable in just about every color, and it rewards you for doing something I think I want players to be rewarded for anyway, which is attacking things. So it plays also nicely in with most of the decks that I play, where I love coming at people with creatures and killing their planeswalkers. Not necessarily the fattest guys, but it just gives you a little bit of draw whenever you hit someone with like your Garruk's Pack Leader or something like that. So I've really liked this card. Plus, it rewards you for killing planeswalkers, which is important to me. I'm really tired of planeswalkers kind of getting a free pass on a lot of those saboteur effects. Yeah, fuck planeswalkers. Shit. I'm just coming and say it again. But yeah, that's how I roll. So,
I think it's kind of neat that you mentioned that, actually, real quick, about the Hunter's Insight and Vengeful Pharaoh. I think it's neat that both of those mention planeswalkers. Like, it's players or planeswalkers trigger, you know, those abilities are tied into that. I think that's kind of nifty. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's kind of a new thing, if I'm not mistaken.
I really hope it's a new and permanent thing, because, like I said, fuck planeswalkers. they don't need any more advantages. But for me, the biggest disappointment of the set, I guess I'll go into the complaint phase while I'm bitching about Planeswalkers, is Mind Unbound. I really wanted this card to be fun and cool, and it never works. It's an enchantment, it's four colorless and double blue. At the beginning of your upkeep, put a lore counter on Mind Unbound, then draw a card for each lore counter on it. So like it would start slow, and you'd get that trickle of cards, and it's expensive, but it's easily abusable with Proliferate, or so it seems. But all that ever happens is you put some effort into making it work, and then someone blows it up, or you don't, and it doesn't draw anything. And then it gets destroyed in, like, a global sweep, or have you drawn two cards. So, for that, you could have played Insight. And, not really a great metric in Commander for success. Like, oh, man, it's just like Insight. Yeah, we'll pass on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could have told you that. I mean, there was this card, Psychic Vortex, which is...
I was just going to mention Psychic Vortex I love, yeah.
With like some tremendous downside, and I've played it, and even if you overcome the downside, like it takes so long to actually get rolling and get any kind of advantage out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not worth it.
One card I wanted to mention as a profound disappointment was Scrambleverse.
Oh, like, that was a disappointment on many levels. The fact that printed it was a big one.
The first time that someone plays that against me at a commander game, I think I will become Scoopy McGee.
I'll salt truck next to you there. I'm fine with that.
I mean, the logistics of resolving that spell, I just can't believe that Wizards printed this thing. Like, I mean, it's just going to be such a nightmare. And you know, there's going to be somebody in EDH that's just going to think that's the coolest thing since sliced bread.
Oh, of course, of course.
They're going to replace their Warp World with Scrambleverse.
Only time it ever resolved, we agreed to just never play with it again. Like, it's the fucking worst. It took us like 25 minutes to figure it out. And it was like halfway through, most people were like, why don't we just not do this and just take it back and draw another card? Like, no, we have to experience it once. And we did, you know, and it was like one of those things you have to experience once, like getting your dick bitten off by an alligator. Like, it's just, you know, if you want a close parallel, like alligators biting your dick, basically.
I'm kind of afraid to follow up after that, but like, I kind of like Scrambleverse, so you're welcome to like kick me off the podcast if you want.
Oh no, you don't worry. We've all proven we're horrible on this show. Very hypocritical of me to boot someone else.
But, I mean, people say it's very unstrategic, and I'm sure most people will play it like that just to like grief people. But I mean, in all honesty, like, it does have some advantages. You know, like if the green player ramps out of control, you've only got like relatively few permanents.
I was gonna say, if you only have 8 mana.
I know. Yo, dog, like, if someone's like going to town with prime time, you know, you have to have like a balancing element, and statistically, this is a balancing element. It can like randomly swing the game back from like an unwinnable position. But
I agree.
In any case,
it has valid applications, but it's the logistics of it.
Right.
Like, it's not fun to resolve at all. It's fucking brutal. It, you know, it is fun. It's type 4.
It's not fun in and of itself, maybe, but it's fun to watch the reactions of other people. This is one of those important tools to have in your kit for when you're building like a griefer deck. It's good to have, because
Donovan's like, been putting together that little bastard General Mischief kit for EDH.
It's, you know, for like for the Mishra deck we were putting together. It's an 8 mana like randomly kill some players because they scoop and leave, you know.
Yeah. And that's how we roll up in this bitch.
I just guess we can't end our discussion about M12 without talking about the worst card in the whole set, which is Doubling Chant. It literally doesn't work at all in EDH, so I guess that's kind of why I wanted to bring it up. And and it's just always sad when they print a green card that I can't use in Omnath, so definitely the worst card in the set, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a bit of a wash, eh? That. I mean, I suppose now it seems like there's so many cards specifically printed for EDH that it's only fair to give something to the 16-4 players, which I do play quite a bit of. But, yeah, that's no good for this podcast, is it?
No. Horrible.
Like, for however much you are winning, win more by that much.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's a thing, right?
Oh, I did want to give a shout out to one card in this in M12 that I think is kind of crazy, actually. The Sundial of the Infinite.
Oh yeah,
good call. Good call. Yeah, that's a good catch.
Like, it kind of blows my mind that this is in the core set, because it's such a weird little card. For people that might not be familiar with it, it's a 2-drop. Artifact for 1 mana, you tap it and you end the turn, and you can only do it during your turn. You know, when you first look at it, you're like, what in the world would I ever want to do this for? But then you start thinking more, and there's all kinds of funky little things to do with it. And one thing that immediately sprung to mind was I have a desire to build a phage commander deck.
Mm-hmm.
Which phage, if you actually try to cast phage from your command zone, you lose because it's not from your hand. But if you put the lose trigger on the stack and then your turn, boom, you've got phage out there. So I've always like one card, of course, is Platinum Angel can protect you from phage killing you. But now I've got Sundial of the Infinite to go along there. So I may actually make my phage deck.
Sweet. I really like it with Kiki-Jiki. That's my tech with that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's very abusable. There's a lot of very fun interactions with it as well. Actually, yeah, I haven't been thinking much with this card. I have a couple sitting around, and I guess I should start using them more. The thing is, it's the kind of card that you have to like really build with it in mind, with a few exceptions. Like Kiki-Jiki is probably one of the cards that interacts with best with the least effort. And I'm generally not a guy that puts in a lot of cards that need a lot of other specific circumstances to make the card work. Because my playgroup are dicks, and they'll always exile the cards. You know? Like, can't even get those back, Andy. Sorry, we don't want to see what you're doing with it. So, yeah, I'm kind of developing an allergy to those kind of cards.
All right, there's two more things I wanted to point out before we close this out. First of all, what are your guys' thoughts on Visions of Beyond?
I've never used it, so I can't really comment.
Yeah, like, I have no comment, almost.
Okay.
I'm not a fan. I mean, I think I think it's just way too conditional, and it's the kind of card that would drive me nuts because I would always draw it early. You know, it'd be the first card I drew after I kept my seven. You know, and
slap in the face.
Right, it would sit there and look at me, and you know, I'd slowly.
Aren't you glad you put this in?
And it, you know, I'd slowly build up my graveyard, and then someone would Tormod's Crypt me. You know, and I would just like start. Thinking about being, you know, Scoopy McGee.
Yeah. Salt fucking all over the place, as it were.
Right.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, Donovan, we know you're going to like this card. Let's not... Come on. It does say draw three cards on it.
It does say draw three cards, which is almost as good as seven.
Yeah, it's like it gives him his fix. You know, it'll stop the twitching.
Okay, but the other thing was, like, looking at these cards, like, Benny pointed out that he was surprised that he printed, like, Sundial of the Infinite in a core set because it's so wonky. But, like, looking at that and World Slayer and Scrambleverse, like, all in this core set, I honestly hope it's, like, a sign of things to come. Because the core set, I mean, for the most part, it's the basics of Magic, but there's a lot, many more, like, intricacies and complexities in this core set than we've seen in a while. And so I like the fact that they're showing... Like, I guess, newer players that they're targeting with this core set, or with all core sets, that there's, like, more to Magic than just, like, playing creatures and bumping them into each other.
I think that's been a bit of a tradition since M10, though. It seems like the complexity of the core set has been increasing, as well as the general quality of the cards. There's been more complex mechanics introduced in each one. Now they're willing to also go back and port mechanics from older sets like Scry and put them into the core sets, which I think is a good sign. So... I think it's a step in the right direction, certainly as far as core set design goes, because historically these have been so boring that I just never bought any. Like, seriously, they're just it's so boring, it's unreal, you know.
And they have white borders too. Don't forget the white borders.
Fuck me on white borders. They are the worst. Whose idea was that? Like, you need a time machine to go back and kick them in the nuts. But yeah, it's not a bad set by any means. It just wasn't very exciting for me personally. You know, there was nothing wrong with it, and I'm sure for many players as well, especially if they weren't around for M11 and M10, then it's a gold mine, right? Which I think is a very real possibility, given the number of newish Commander players that were probably born with the release of the Commander product. I don't think it's a coincidence there were a lot of really good Commander cards, but something that I actually want to touch on real quick, one last note here. Donovan mentioned his sort of griefing toolkit. You also mentioned World Slayer. Which is the worst as far as that goes. Like, it's almost taunting you when you use it, you know?
Well, this fits perfectly into a Voltron strategy. Like, Kanda?
Yeah,
like,
Kanda.
Or any indestructible legend, like, you just equip this guy and go to town.
Yeah, go to town for 3 damage per turn forever.
Well, yeah, or Thrun. You know, you can regenerate from that.
Hmm.
I had an indestructible... themed EDH deck where I had a Dark Steel Mirror with a bunch of +1/+1 counters on it and World Slayer. It was
pretty epic. They look so innocuous.
It's pretty sweet. Speaking of World Slayer, I have when M12 came out, I have a friend of mine that does a lot of judging, and he ended up cracking open like a couple boxes of M12. And he said it was like literally every 5 packs had a World Slayer as his rare. And he started rage shredding them. Like, I think at last count he had shredded like 25 World Slayers.
Wow.
He was so pissed off about it.
That's a lot of world slaying.
He's making the other ones worth more.
Yeah, he's manipulating the market values.
That's right. So if you see a price spike on the World Slayer, you might want to tip off Mr. Medina about the...
You know the secret origins now. We know where it's coming from.
That's right.
All right, so that's it for our hands-on set review of M12. This is a little more free-form than usual, but I think it went pretty well. If you have your own picks or cards maybe we did not discuss, feel free to send those in. I'm going to give you the contact information right now because we're moving into the outro. So that rounds out Commander Cast Season 4, Episode 5. In this episode, we were talking about Douchology, which will be a new recurring segment that I hope you all had fun with. I do want to say real quick, don't take that too seriously, obviously. I did go on record saying that I think the term douchebag is really bad for Commander, and in general it is. So don't be calling everybody a douchebag here and be like, oh, well, I heard on Commander Cast, you fit into this category, you're a salt truck, you know. I don't think too many people would appreciate that. We also were talking about some archetype rundown Voltron action. We did a rather wild and unseemly archenemy survival handbook, where you might have to work to get the wisdom out of that one. Four horses and a hands-on set review of M12. So if you have any comments on any of those subjects, we'll give out the contact information now. If you want to get a hold of me, my name's Andy, a.k.a. Ghosts. You can get a hold of me at commandercast@gmail.com. I'm at commandercast on Twitter. And there's always CommanderCast.com's lovely new comment section where you can comment using a variety of them social media tools that are so popular with the kids these days. But speaking of being social, let's move on to the other people here so you can get a hold of them through whatever methodology we'd like, starting with Donovan.
All right, so like I said at the beginning of the cast, I go by Dosu over most of the internet. That's D0SU, and you can find me at, like, MTG Salvation. That's probably your best bet. I also have a Twitter account and various emails. But I don't check them very often because I'm kind of irresponsible like that. So, yeah, if you really need to reach me, then MTG Salvation is your best.
All right, and then we got Cassidy. How would people get a hold of you?
My Twitter handle is @WriterOfWrong. I'm trying to get more into it, like, against my better judgment.
It's hard.
Yeah, it is. probably just Facebooking me at my name is the easiest because I'm on that all the time. You can email me at csilver85@gmail.com if you like, and definitely check out the TCG Player articles that are coming up either Thursday and Friday.
All right, and then finally, Benny.
My name's Benny Smith. I write every week, every Friday on starcitygames.com, and I've got my email address there, which is starcitygeezer@gmail.com. And I've also got links to, I have a Facebook page and my Twitter, which is Blair Witch Green on Twitter. And I've also got a non-magic blog for those who might be interested in my musings over there. And it's called myidealwoman.wordpress.com.
And that one is, as the title says, all about the ladies.
Yes.
So if you're so inclined, yeah, go over there and give that a flip through. All right, so I would like to just say real quick, I would like to thank absolutely everybody that sent anything into the Gifts Given charity drive. It has been a runaway success, and we're only in week one, so I have no idea where it's going to go, but it's been way more successful than I thought it would be at any phase already. So I'm really hoping that things keep going, probably not at this pace, because that would be a ludicrous expectation. But like I said, it already has gone above and beyond where I ever expected it to be. So it's already an unqualified success in my mind. I'm sure the people at Child's Play will agree. If you would like to find out more about this charity drive and how you can contribute, you can go back and listen to the Charity Cases segment, which I did earlier in the podcast, or you can over to CommanderCast.com. There's links all over the place pertaining to that. And I would personally appreciate it if you were to help out with that. If you can't, there's certainly no problem there either, because there's going to be all kinds of awesome prizes being given to people that do. There's going to be awesome stuff up for auction, which you could buy if you were so inclined as well.
I guess while Andy's asking for shameless self-promotion, like, I just joined a band. I'm playing drums in this band called Iron Circle. It's all one word. You can look them up on Facebook or Reverb Nation. And if you don't like the music, that's cool. But if you do, then please come to our shows. That would be excellent.
That's awesome. What kind of music?
I guess it's like probably metal. It's probably somewhere between hard rock and metal. But their old drummer is really good, so I got like big shoes to fill.
Good luck.
Cool. Yeah, good luck, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be fine. You got the mad skills.
Awesome.
So that's it for this week of CommanderCast. We'll be back next week, as always, mtgcast.com, quietspeculation.com, and commandercast.com with more community strategy and technology. Motherfucker. Okay, go ahead. Let's hear it.
Well, this is my son's personal favorite. He likes me to do this for him at least once a week. But you, sir, are a jackass.
That's good.
Of course, having ass in it, I think, makes it particularly fun for my 9-year-old. But
well, it just did the same thing to a bunch of people that are all 20 plus. You know how it is.